All right, it's time to get started. I know I said the last 2 weeks, I said I was going to talk to the preacher about running late. And this week was the worst of them all. So, good news is, Tom's coming back this week, so you don't have to listen to that guy again for a while. So maybe that'll help for next week. Well, I've passed out an outline of Deuteronomy 12 through 26. This is the large section of the book that is concerned with some of the specific laws of the covenant that God had made with the people. Previously, I'd shown you one way of looking at this that aligns the different chapters with the Ten Commandments. Those of you who take notes may still have some of those as well. I don't think this is necessarily in opposition to that. That's much more of a thematic, broad brush sort of way of looking at it. This is more detailed. Initially, I'd planned, you might remember, on kind of covering this section of the text along that Ten Commandments sort of way, looking at a couple of commandments, so to speak, at a time. Then when Tom left, I decided to slow down on chapters, 6 through 11 or so. And I had it planned out very well so that it would all line up and I'd be right on pace when he got back. And then two things happened. One, last Wednesday night I didn't teach Deuteronomy. I did something different instead, which put me a class behind. And two, I can't count, which put me another class behind. And so I decided, rather than stretching things out otherwise, what we're going to do is work our way through larger sections of text with less commentary from me along the way. I've done the kind of study I would typically do to teach a class. I've just not brought a bunch of notes with me because I know that'll really slow things down. So we're going to be working our way through the text kind of section by section, reading it all so you can get it in mind along the way. And I'll make a few comments here or there after each section. Certainly, you're welcome to ask questions about anything that strike you or make comments about anything that strikes you. But this is going to be more textual and less teaching about the text than is typically the case. It's not my preference, but it's a good way to work our way through this text this way. So here is our outline we've been showing along the way. And this is the same thing that you've got on the paper in front of you, just fewer points. It's just the six main points rather than all the breakdown. So today what we're going to do is look at this first section, 12 through 16. Next time we'll pick up in 16:18 and work through chapter 20. And then we'll do 21 through 26 in a third class, and that'll get us back on schedule. So the next three classes will be this kind of format, which again is not my preference, but it's where we are, and I think it'll be our best option moving forward as far as we go. So to break this down, again, this is just matching the outline you have on the paper, but I'll keep putting these kinds of things on the PowerPoint for those of you who lose the paper along the way over the next three classes. I'll try not to lose mine, and maybe we can have some idea. So this is where we're going. Any comments left over from past classes or anything else we need to talk about first? You don't have any idea what I'm talking about? Okay. All right. Well, we're going to begin by reading chapter 12, which is a little bit of a lengthy chapter, but it's all in the same theme. Let me make one comment. Before, notice chapter 13 moves us into idolatry, the issue of idolatry. Some people break the end of chapter 13, they make the break a little bit earlier and start with 12:29 going into the section on idolatry. Your Bible, if it has headings, may even indicate that right before chapter 29 is a new section starting to talk about idolatry. The reason I'm keeping it all together is that verses 29 through 32 of chapter 12 match very closely in content and sometimes in specific words with verses 1 through 4 of chapter 12. And so it's, again, one of these sandwiching sorts of things, bracketing the section in the middle. And so I think it pretty clearly goes with the same thing, even if it is still at the same time segueing us into the issue of idolatry. But 1 through 4 and 29 through 32 are bookends to this larger section. So, with that said, Deuteronomy chapter 12. These are the statutes and rules that you shall be careful to do in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall surely destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills, and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and burn their Asherim with fire. You shall chop down the carved images of their gods and destroy their name out of that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all his tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution that you present, your vow offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your households and all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing what is right in his own eyes, for you have not as yet come to the rest and to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you. But when you go over the Jordan and live in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and when he gives you rest from all your enemies around so that you live in safety, then to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution that you present, and all your finest vow offerings that you vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male servants and your female servants, and the Levite that is within your town, since he has no portion or inheritance with you. Take care that you do not offer your burnt offerings at any place that you see, but at the place that the Lord will choose in one of your tribes. And there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I am commanding you. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your towns as much as you desire, according to the blessing of the Lord your God that he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, as of the gazelle and of the deer. Only you shall not eat the blood. You shall pour it out on the earth like water. You may not eat within your towns the tithe of your grain or of your wine or of your oil or of the firstborn of your herd or of your flock or any of your vow offerings that you vow or your freewill offerings or the contribution that you present, but you shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place that the Lord your God will choose, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant and the Levite who is within your towns, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you undertake. Take care that you do not neglect the Levite as long as you live in your land. When the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he has promised you, and you say, I will eat meat because you crave meat, you may eat meat wherever you desire. If the place that the Lord your God will choose to put his name is too far from you, then you may kill any of your herd or your flock which the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your towns whenever you desire. Just as the gazelle or the deer is eaten, so you may eat of it. The unclean and the clean alike may eat of it. Only be sure that you do not eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with flesh. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it out over the earth like water. You shall not eat it, that you may go, that all may go well with you and with your children after you, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. But the holy things that are due from you and your vow offerings you shall take, and you shall go to the place that the Lord will choose, and offer your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, and the altar of the Lord your God. The blood of your sacrifice shall be poured out on the altar of the Lord your God, but the flesh you may eat. Be careful to obey all these words that I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations whom you go into dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, take care that you not be ensnared to follow them after they have been destroyed before you. And that you may not, you do not inquire about their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods, that I may also do the same? You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abominable thing that the Lord hates, they have done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it. All right, let me start by asking if there's any thoughts or questions or comments on that text from you as I've read it. Steve?
There seems to be a lot of emphasis on like, the unclean and the clean both being able to participate in like, eating of the meat. I think that was repetitive.
Yeah, that is an interesting detail in particular, that the unclean and clean alike may eat. And the point, I think, seems to be that even if, and this is the unclean and the clean person, I believe, whether you're ceremonially clean or ceremonially unclean, you know, you can't go to the temple and worship if you're ceremonially unclean. But if you're just eating, you can. There's no, you know, if you're killing an animal to eat at your home, it doesn't matter if you're clean or unclean, you can eat. But if you're going to worship, that's a very different thing. And the distinction seems to be between those who are going to worship and what you're just doing in your daily life. And that there is no distinction, really, to speak of between clean and unclean for daily life kinds of things. What else? Anything else? Yeah, Stephen?
Is there a particular purpose that you understand, at least? Basically, you said several times, include the Levites in your parties? I mean, basically, do they leave the priests out? Are they too good for them or
something? Well, the priests are Levites. All priests are Levites, not all Levites are priests. And so they may be included by implication there. Now, the reason they're constantly included is because they live off of the generosity of others. They're like the poor. We'll get to a chapter later that talks about how to take care of the poor in your society or their society later on. The Levites are in that same category in a sense, and that is they live on the generosity of others. And that's part of why they are to be included in all of these things, because, you know, their services to the Lord, their inheritance is spread out all over the place. They receive their food and their money from the offerings of the people at the temple and other things as well. So that's part of why they're included in all of that. But it is noteworthy along those lines. Notice in verse 12, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male servants, your female servants, and the Levite that is within your town. This is a time of rejoicing, and that in itself, keep an eye out for that word or that idea as we go through these chapters where we think, oh man, all of these laws, how awful it must have been to live back then. There's a constant focus on the joy that this was supposed to bring to them, to be in this kind of relationship with God. So the rejoicing itself is a noteworthy point to keep in mind, but it's not, again, the aristocratic landowners that get to go rejoice, while the women stay back home and the slaves keep doing their thing and the Levites, well, they've got to go deal with temple stuff. Everybody is joining together in this. No one is excluded from this, and we'll see that kind of idea as well. Anything else here? One other thing that I'll mention that I think is noteworthy, even as we look forward into the New Testament as well, notice how many times Jerusalem and the temple are called the place that will be named. You know, the place that is going to be. Is that because God didn't know where it was going to be? I mean, we saw in a previous chapter talking about the blessings and the cursings when they come, and it's going to be at these two mountains, Ebal and Gerizim. You remember that? And there was that really kind of weird way of describing where it is in the land that surely made a lot of sense to them back then, but it's hard for us to grasp now exactly what all that means. You know, like turn left at the third brown tree and then go up the hill until you see the rock that's shaped like a sheep. I mean, that's not what it was, but it was that kind of thing. I mean, they knew something about the geography of the land. God knew where he was going to go and what he was going to do. The emphasis is not on Jerusalem as a city, but notice in verse 5, seek the place that the Lord your God will choose and put his name and make his habitation. The reason why it's unnamed is because it would be really, really easy for them to get hung up on the city of Jerusalem and the building of the temple. And we know that because they got hung up on the city of Jerusalem and the building, the temple. And what is important is not the city or the building. What is important is the fact that God's name has been placed there, and that is where God abides. That's what's important. And that also then paves the way for Jesus to say in John chapter 4 to the woman at the well, you know, yeah, right now the Jews are right and the Samaritans are wrong about where they worship, but that's not how it's going to be. Because it's not about a physical location, because God is spirit, and worship is of a different sort in the new covenant. But that makes really good sense when it's not about a physical location here either. Any physical location would have done if that had been where God chose to put his name and make his habitation. So that emphasis even, I think, is significant. Are any last thoughts here on chapter 12 before we forge forward? Yeah, Guy?
It's interesting to me
Right. And they do face that. I mean, that is a constant appeal to the Israelites to go after the Baal. And in particular, it has to do with the weather cycle and Baal being the weather god and trying to you know, do whatever they can to make it rain a little bit more. And the point throughout the Bible is that those are not real gods. And that's, you know, why do they tear all this stuff down? You know, what's the big deal? Well, those aren't real gods. They don't do anything. They just draw you away from the God that you're in a relationship with, the God who's given you everything that you are, everything that you are and everything that you have in everything. And you respond to that all-encompassing gift by going after someone else instead. And you think about that in human terms. This is not a great analogy by any stretch, but, you know, imagine, you're 18 years old out of high school and you can't find a job. You have no skills, no education. You can't pay for college. And somebody sees you and it feels bad and takes a chance on you and gives you a job. And, you know, you work your way up through the company, not really because you've been so great, but because they're helping you out along the way and they're giving you chances one after the other. To the point that you have some stability, finally, in life. And what you do is the first chance you get, you run off after some other job. You know, there's a kind of ingratitude toward the guy that gave you the chance in that I think we understand that's really not the right thing to do, especially if it's, you know, a worse job to begin with. I'm going to go after this other guy and make $30,000 a year less. That's what I'm going to do. Well, that's stupid and ungrateful. Well, that's kind of what chasing after idols are. It's stupid and ungrateful. There is no power. There are no other gods. They can't do anything for you anyway. And you're rejecting the one who has given you everything far more than giving you a chance on some kind of job. And so, again, I think we can kind of understand that in human terms. For some reason, we have a little bit more of a difficulty with idolatry. And that also then helps shape some of the harshness of the language in chapter 13. Chapter 13 is one of those chapters that's hard for us to read. If we're going to be honest about it, because it's a whole lot of people needing to die because they're going after another god, and that does not sit well on, you know, postmodern Western ears. But that's what we encounter here. We could talk some more about that a little bit later. But just by way of warning, be ready for a chapter that's a little bit rough around the edges from kind of a modern sensibilities. Chapter 13, if a prophet or dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder that he tells you comes to pass, and if he says, let us go after other gods which you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and hold fast to him. But that prophet or dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has taught rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of slavery to make you leave the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If your brother, the son of your mother, or your son or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul, entices you secretly, saying, let us go after and serve other gods, which neither you nor your fathers have known, some of the gods of the peoples who are around you, whether near you or far off from you, from the one end of the earth to the other, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him, nor shall you conceal him, but you shall kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. You shall stone him to death with stones, because he sought to draw you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and never again do any such wickedness as this among you. If you hear in one of your cities, which the Lord your God is giving you to dwell there, that certain worthless fellows have gone out among you and have drawn away the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, then you shall inquire and make search and ask diligently, and behold, if it be true and certain that such an abomination has been done among you, you shall surely put the inhabitants of that city to the sword, devoting it to destruction, all who are in it, with it and its cattle, with the edge of the sword. You shall gather all its spoil into the midst of the open open square and burn the city and all its spoil with fire as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God. It shall be a heap forever. It shall never be built again. None of the devoted things shall stick to your hand, that the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy and have compassion on you and multiply you as he swore to your fathers, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God, keeping all his commandments that I am commanding you today and doing what is right in the sight of the Lord your God. All right, a couple things that I'll say first on this chapter. Obviously, this kind of breaks down into three basic sections: the false prophet who leads you away, the close relative or friend who would lead you away, and certain worthless fellows who would lead an entire city away. For what it's worth, that's the same Hebrew phrase that you find in Naboth's vineyard story, where Jezebel gets certain worthless fellows to testify against Naboth. I don't know if that's an incredibly significant point, but I think it's an interesting connection at the very least. So that's the three parts of it. The last part, I think, helps us see something of the significance of this chapter, and that is the city is being it's being given the holy war treatment, basically. This is a city of Israel that is being treated the same way Jericho was treated. Everything dies. All of the plunder is burned. It is never to be rebuilt again. It is treated as a Canaanite city, is what it amounts to. And this is exactly what we've said several times earlier, that the Israelites are being told, if you behave like Canaanites, you can expect to be treated like Canaanites. If you follow after their gods, you're going to receive the same fate as them who followed after their gods. That's the point all the way back to Genesis 15. God says, I'm not ready to destroy them yet. There's still time. You know, they may yet repent. That's not the exact language, but that's clearly the implication, knowing the rest of the Bible. There's time, but when the time comes for their judgment, then I'm going to drive them out and I'm going to bring your people into this land. Well, if you start doing the same thing they were doing, you're going to receive the same punishment. And again, it's because there is a God who has given them everything that they have and everything that they are and has given them rules that are for their benefit to give them the best life they can possibly have, and they're pretending like he doesn't exist and pretending like rocks and trees and stuff are God instead, and chasing after those things and acting in an unholy way in general, and you get the fertility cults and everything else. That is an evil that is to be purged. Now, the other thing that's worth noting here, as we think about this, is the reason why it is so important is because of the communal solidarity that there was, and because of the way that God acted in time and space more directly than he does now. The entire point of so much of Deuteronomy is, if you follow these laws that I'm giving you for your own good, then everything is going to be great. And if you don't follow these laws and you break them instead, then things are going to be bad. There's going to be drought, there's going to be famine, you're going to be taken away by foreign powers. And what that means is, if someone comes in and starts teaching idolatry, someone starts drawing them away after other gods, it's not something where you can afford to say, well, that's fine for him, whatever, he can live his own life. Because that is something that is ultimately going to then damage the entire community and bring judgment on all of them. You remember what happened when Achan took the plunder from Jericho? It wasn't Achan who died in the next battle. The entire army suffered defeat. And if one person in one family starts chasing after idols, and the whole family starts chasing after idols, and then the whole community starts chasing after idols, judgment's coming on all of Israel. And so it is vital to keep the evil out of their community, is the point here that's running through all of it. So, thoughts about chapter 13?
I guess you still see that today. Community standards move and change, and some are better, some are worse. And it does affect, it does end up affecting a lot in terms of morals. Whether it's a blue law or...
Right. And I think it's important also to understand that this is not a chapter that's about the vengefulness of God. This is a chapter about God not wanting to have to do this. He's giving them these warnings to not chase after, you know, false gods. Here I am, and here I am offering everything that you need and then some, And the reality is, if you sin against me, there will be judgment. That's the nature of a holy, perfect God and a sinful people. And so please don't do that. And you know what? I'll tell you just how severe it's going to be, you know, to remind you this is not something you want to be participating in and engaging in. So the whole thing is designed to prevent this from ever having to happen. You know, if God was just vengeful and angry and wanting to smite people left and right, what he would do is not tell people anything and then punish them anyway. Oh, you sinned. How was I supposed to know? Who cares? You sinned, you're dead. Well, that's not what you find anywhere. It's God doing everything he can to do good for them and prevent them from ever having to have this happen. And then when they do, you know, as so well put in that last song that we were just singing, Christ took that wrath of God for us. So God himself bore his own punishment so that we don't have to. And how remarkable of a thing that is. Charlie? Yeah. It is one of those things, and I think we see this in other places in Leviticus, if not later on in Deuteronomy as well, where the person who makes the accusation is the one who throws the first stone. You know, that's kind of a little bit of the backdrop in the John 8 woman caught in adultery story. It raises the ante, so to speak, on making an accusation against somebody, to know that you are going to be the one who is leading the execution, and also that it's a communal execution. The people will be doing this as well, which again, I can't imagine the difficulty of it, living in that sort of culture. We also don't know how many times this ever actually happened, as far as that goes. That's the other thing. We read through these laws, and we see what's supposed to happen. If you've read the rest of the Old Testament, you know they didn't do a very good job of keeping the law. So who knows how frequently, if at all, this sort of thing happened. But it's a communal process. And what that means is that everybody sees the consequence. It's one thing to know there's a consequence and then for someone to be taken away behind a closed door and executed. And, you know, that's bad enough. But when the community participates in that process, there is a reality to consequences that they are experiencing that we can't even really begin to fathom. And so it's, you know, a hedge against idolatry still is another way of it. But, yeah, the your hand being the one to throw the first stone, so to speak, you know, it does, you know, point in the direction of the accuser being the one to lead that process. Yeah, Kristen. Yeah, I think that this is not someone who is wrestling with difficulties in their faith. You know, this is someone who is actively pursuing idolatry. And not just pursuing idolatry individually, but trying to draw other people with them as well, is part of the constant picture of this chapter. So, yeah, it's not, I'm wrestling with doubts, oh, stone him! No, it's someone who has said, I'm going to follow after Dagon or, you know, Molech or whoever else, and let's get everyone else to go with me. So that's a good thought. All right. Chapter 14 then moves us into some more miscellaneous sorts of religious practices. Some are connected to clean and unclean foods, and then tithing is the part of the second half. So chapter 14, you are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or make any baldness on your foreheads for the dead, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any abomination. These are the animals that you may eat, the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the ibex, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. Let me stop for a second and say, as we're going through all of these different animals, your translations may vary. Sometimes that's because there's debate as to what a Hebrew word means from one animal to the next, and sometimes it's because we're not entirely sure what that means. So there was likely to be some variation as we go. Verse 6, every animal that parts the hoof and has the hoof cloven in two and chews the cud among the animals you may eat. Yet of those that chew the cud and have the hoof cloven, you shall not eat these, the camel, the hare, the rock badger, because they chew the cud, but they do not part the hoof, are unclean for you. And the pig, because it parts the hoof but does not chew the cud, is unclean for you. Their flesh you shall not eat, and their carcasses you shall not touch. Of all that are in the waters, you may eat these. Whatever has fins and scales, you may eat, and whatever does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. It is unclean for you. You may eat all clean birds, but these are the ones you shall not eat: the eagle, the bearded vulture, the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind, every raven of any kind, the ostrich, the night hawk, the seagull, the hawk of any kind, the little owl and the short-eared owl and the barn owl, and the tawny owl and the carrion vulture, and the cormorant, the stork, and the heron of any kind, the hoopoe and the bat. And all winged insects are unclean for you. They shall not be eaten. All clean winged things you may eat. You shall not eat anything that has died naturally. You may give it to the sojourner who is within your towns, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. You shall tithe all the yield of your seed that comes from the field year by year. And before the Lord your God, in the place that he will choose and make his name dwell there, you shall tithe, you shall eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, the firstborn of your herd, of your flock, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And if the way is too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithe, when the Lord your God blesses you because the place is too far from you, which the Lord your God chooses to set his name there, then you shall turn it into money and bind up the money in your hand and go to the place that the Lord your God chooses and spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink, whatever your appetite craves. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. And you shall not neglect the Levite who is within your towns, for he has no portion or inheritance with you. At the end of every 3 years, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in the same year and lay it up within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the sojourner and the fatherless and the widow who are within your towns shall come and eat and be filled, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands that you do. The clean and unclean, obviously, this is the sort of thing that does go away as you come into the New Testament. That's a point that is made several times in the New Testament. And the reason I bring that up is not just because it means we can eat bacon, although that's a very important point as well, of course, but because what stands behind this helps explain the event that Peter, the experience that Peter has in his vision. You might think as you read in Acts 10, you know, the sheet is lowered with all kinds of animals on it, clean and unclean, and the voice says, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And then go preach the gospel to a Gentile. Well, what do those two things have to do with each other? Well, there's this, I guess, kind of clean and unclean thing going on. And that's kind of part of it. But what's important is that the distinction in clean and unclean really has less to do with the animals specifically and more to do with marking Israel out as a holy people different from the nations. What is the distinction between clean and unclean? Well, there are some specific things, the, you know, cloven hoof and chews the cud, and then the fish with fins and scales. And there are different ways of interpreting, you know, why those things are significant for what it's worth. The one that I've come across that I think is most compelling is you can eat what's normal and what's abnormal you can't. So a fish with fins and scales, the normal fish. Fish that doesn't have scales, there's something not as normal about that. That's not the standard sort of fish. And so it's standard versus, I want to say substandard, but non-standard perhaps. A cloven hoof is a typical hoof. A non-cloven hoof is less typical. So those are the kinds of things that may be behind it. But what really stands behind it is you are a holy people to God. And so that's why you do this. This makes you different from everybody else. So whatever the other distinguishing things may be in the clean and unclean, what matters is you're not like everyone else. You're God's holy people. And so then when you bring this up to Acts chapter 10, and you can eat anything, it's not just, well, there was clean and unclean, now there's not clean and unclean, but now there's no distinction between God's holy people, the nation of Israel, and the unholy Gentiles anymore. And so it's bigger than just the idea of clean and unclean is being done away with at that point. Yeah, Charlie? Sorry, you can't eat flying ants or dragonflies.
Then how did John eat locusts?
That's a good question. I would have to think a little bit more about how that would be classified. It's again one of those things. I don't know ancient, entomological. Classifications. We may look at this and say, well, obviously a locust has wings. They may not have thought in those kinds of terms. So I don't know what the answer to that is, to be honest. But he's not the only one, is he? Weren't there others who ate locusts too? He's the one that's most famous for it. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that question is, how the locust fits into this law specifically. It's a good question. Aren't you around when I'm studying to ask me these questions that I can maybe try to find them? For what it's worth, the you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk is the basis for modern Jewish kosher laws, which include keeping your meat and your dairy separate. You can't have a cheeseburger in Israel. You've got to keep the meat and the dairy separate. You can have hamburger. You can have a piece of cheese. You can't have it at the same time. Well, that is an application that is coming out of boiling a goat. A young goat in its mother's milk. Now, how they got to that application, I don't know. But the meat-dairy distinction in modern Jewish kosher laws root back to this. So, just for what that's worth. The tithing, again, this is the significance is really the two things. One is that this is part of how those who are dependent on society eat. Is by the tithing. You've got the Levite and the sojourner and the fatherless and the widow within your towns eating this way there at the end. But then also that this is an occasion for rejoicing. The tithe is not supposed to be a burden to the people. It's supposed to be something for them to rejoice in. Look at how blessed we are. We have an opportunity to give back to God and help other people in the process. And how wonderful of a thing that is supposed to be the mentality of the tithe. Charlie, are we getting the first bell at 10 till? Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got 10 minutes, basically, to get through two last sections. Any more thoughts here on chapter 14? There's not really as much especially interesting here, I don't think. I mean, we can nitpick at it and say things, but... All right, moving on then into chapter 15, the Sabbath year. This is probably the most interesting, this and chapter 12 are two of the most interesting pieces, sorry, whacking the microphone, of this entire section. So, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor. His brother, because of the Lord's release, has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. But there will be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, if only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today. For the Lord your God will bless you, as he promised you, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. You shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any one of your towns within your land that the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, the seventh year, the year of release, is near, and your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and all that you undertake. For there will never cease to be poor in your land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy, to the poor in the land. If your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you, and he shall serve you for 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed him, you shall give... has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. But if he says, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an awl and put it through his ear to the door, and he shall be your slave forever. And if your female slave... And to your female slave you shall do the same. It shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you, for at half the cost of a hired worker he has served you 6 years. So the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. All the firstborn males that are born of your herd and of your flock you shall dedicate to the Lord your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You shall eat it, you and your household, because the Lord your God year... by year at the place, before the Lord your God, year by year at the place the Lord will choose. But if it has any blemish, if it is lame or blind or has any serious blemish, whatever, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You shall eat it within your towns. The clean and the unclean alike may eat it as though it were a gazelle or deer. But you shall not eat its blood. You shall pour it out onto the ground like water. So the Sabbath year, the year of release, it's really two things. It's a release of debts and a release of slaves. There's a fair amount to talk about here that we don't really have time to get into. One thing is there's some debate as to what's being released. Is it the entire debt that's being released? Is it that year's payment that is being released? Is it the pledge? You know, you put up a collateral for a loan. Is it the pledge that is being released? All of those have been suggested. It's really hard to know for certain which it is. What we do know is over the years, the Jews ultimately treated it, at least in later rabbinical writings that we have where they talk about this, it's the pledge, or it's everything. Everything's being released. However much debt someone has is going away. That's the way it was applied later on, as far as back as we can go in Jewish interpretation, whatever it meant originally. And that leads to a bit of a problem. In verse 9, take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say the seventh year is near. And you can see how that's going to work, right? If it's year one, I'll give someone a loan. He's got 6 years to pay, and then I'll free him of whatever's left. If it's year five and a half, and someone asks for a loan, you think, oh, man, I'm not going to get hardly any of this back before the seventh year comes. I'm going to lose all of this. And so the idea is, no, give to him freely. Don't be grudging when you give to him, and God will bless you. And so there is that kind of foresight into the mentality of what might happen as a result of this. Then the other thing that's worth mentioning in particular is the Hebrew man or Hebrew woman that is sold in verse 12. The word Hebrew is either the ethnicity of a person who is a Hebrew, or it's a relation to a similar sounding word, hapiru, which was a social class of person. A hapiru was someone who was basically uprooted from their home and they were in the working class in a foreign place. And sometimes they became slaves in a foreign place. And you could see why that word would have become associated with the Hebrew ethnicity. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, uprooted from their homeland, and they're traveling around in another person's country. The Israelites in Egypt, same sort of thing. But what that would mean then is if that's what is in view here, this is not an ethnic Hebrew who was sold to you, but someone who's a foreigner, ultimately, who lives among you, who has been sold as a slave to you, if that's the case. Again, it's really hard to know with any certainty which of those it is. But the point is, whoever it is on the seventh year, they're freed. They're no longer your slave. And you can't be upset about it because you've been getting labor out of them for half the price up to this point. And not only are you freeing them, you are providing for them out of your bounty so they'll have a chance to make it. Now, there is, of course, the possibility that someone might say, hey, I kind of like the situation I'm in here. We've got a great relationship. Yeah, I'm working for you, but it's working out great for everybody. I think I want to stay. I don't want to be freed. Well, at that point, If that's the decision they're making, they're becoming your slave in perpetuity at that point. And notice it's not, I think you're a great slave, why don't you stay around? It's the person saying, I want to do this. It is totally the initiative of the slave. The owner has to let them free otherwise, is the law. So that's what stands behind that. Any other thoughts here on chapter 15? We'll read through chapter 16 quickly. It's a bunch of feasts. So it's, again, a little bit less exciting. All right, chapter 16, verses 1 through 17 to wrap up our reading today. Observe the month of Aviv and keep the Passover to the Lord your God. For what it's worth, Aviv is later going to be called the month of Nisan. So those 2 months are the same thing. This is the older word, and it gets dropped at some point. Observe the month of Aviv and keep the Passover to the Lord your God. In the month of Aviv, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night, and you shall offer the Passover sacrifice to the Lord your God from the flock or the herd at the place that the Lord will choose to make his name dwell there. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that all the days of your life you may remember the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. No leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall you eat any of the flesh that you sacrifice on the evening of the first day. Nor shall any of the flesh that you sacrifice in the evening of the first day remain all night until the morning. You may not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, but at the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell in it. There you shall offer the Passover sacrifice in the evening at the sunset at the time you came out of Egypt. And you shall cook it and eat it at the place that the Lord your God will choose. And in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. For 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it. You shall count 7 weeks. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time the sickle is first put to the standing grain. Then you shall keep the feast of weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give to the Lord your God who blesses you. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite who is within your towns, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow who are among you, at the place the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. You shall keep the Feast of Booths 7 days, when you have gathered in the produce from your threshing floor and your wine press. You shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your towns. For 7 days you shall keep the feast of the Lord your God at the place the Lord will choose, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God at the place that he will choose, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. They shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God that he has given you. So, this is pretty straightforward. Here are the 3 big feasts, annual feasts. They're to go to Jerusalem, ultimately is going to be the place to keep. The Passover is linked closely with the Feast of Unleavened Bread here. The Feast of Weeks is Pentecost. Pentecost comes from the Greek word, I think it's in Leviticus when the Feast of Weeks is talked about. The Greek word in the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament is very close to English Pentecost, and that's where that comes from. The Feast of Booths is a harvest sort of feast as well. All right. Any last thoughts about chapter 16 up to this point? Yeah, Greg?
Just that they were rejoicing.
Yeah. Yeah, so those 2 things, the rejoicing that's supposed to be a part of it, and the full community, men and women, children and slaves and free, and orphans and widows and fatherless and Levites, everybody is a part of this. So it's a rejoicing, a time of rejoicing, and it's full community, not just, again, the wealthy elite who are part of this. All right, well, we'll pick up in 16:18 next time and work through the end of chapter 20 in the same kind of way.